Professors FM.
Okay, welcome everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast. This is Mike Lewis from Emory University and, well, Doug Battle from Emory University as well, brought to you by the Emory Marketing Analytics Center. Doug, before we get into it, I want to do a little bit of a professor kind of gig here, sort of for the people, but, you know, the veneer of intellectual content. So, Doug, when I think about fandom, and, you know, you guys can all dig into this, when we did this short course on fandom analytics that's up on the website still. We did it about a year ago. But the foundations of fandom are, in some ways, relatively simple, but they're profound for folks that want to go into this business. So, you know, number one, fandom is about belonging. You know, Doug, you are, everyone that's listened to this, I was talking to some folks this weekend, he says, the question was like, is that kid that's on there with you, is he a student at Georgia or is he a graduate? And it's like,
he's a grown man,
but you are clearly a part of Bulldog Nation. And so within any, and so fandom is about belonging. All groups have hierarchies. How are fan hierarchies determined, right? I mean, you were a hardcore fan back in the day back in Athens, right? I mean, Spike Squad.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Painted up every week, up at who knows how early in the morning to get in line to be front row, which is a strange thing to me, by the way, because everybody pushes to get front row of a football game. And actually, front row, you don't have the best view. Like, I like to be like 30, 40, 50th row, that lower level. But for some reason, students wanted to be on the front row. I only did because we painted up, and that was kind of what we had to do to get on TV and do our thing. But anyway, that's a whole side note. But yeah, I was pretty intense. Pretty intense Georgia fan. No regrets about that. Love the Dogs. Just mellowed out a little bit and become, or hide my intensity a little bit. It's still down there, though.
Okay. And so commitment. So an expression of commitment.
Yeah.
Painting up, wearing shoulder pads.
Painting up, especially when it's like 17 degrees outside. Well, you get really every extreme in Georgia. You get first game of the year. I mean, my first game was against Clemson. It must have been 100 degrees and humid outside. By the end of the game, my paint is just
melted
off. I look horrible. It really was a bad look. But then later that same season, you get Auburn and it's 17 degrees and you're without a shirt on with cold paint. Putting paint on when it's cold is no fun. But yeah, it's all about commitment.
Okay. It's about commitment. It's also about knowledge, right? It's part of being in a fan community is sort of knowing the lore, knowing everything that's going on, being an expert.
Yeah. Yeah. And we, to join that, the Spike Squad, you know, that group, you actually had an interview and they would quiz you on the lore.
Oh, I didn't know that. What was, do you remember any of the tougher questions?
Well, none of them were tough for me.
Okay.
You did have to, this was
okay.
Little...
Let me stop you there. Okay. And folks, just see what he just did there. None of them were tough for me. So he is actually making my point in terms of establishing where he is in this hierarchy. He didn't have to study.
Yeah. No, you do have to know the, I think the tricky one was, it's kind of funny, but Georgia's a school where no one really knows the, not the fight song, but I guess the alma mater, what do they call it? Anyway, you had to memorize the lyrics to this song. And then, yeah, they would ask you about what year did Georgia win the national championship, name so many players from this team. And then there was really basic stuff, like who are Georgia's biggest rivals? Because this, obviously you don't want someone representing the biggest fans of the university that don't even know that. So it kind of was everything from simple to, like, you know, some trickier stuff, like knowing all the words to different fight songs.
And so, you know, just to keep score here. So foundations of fandom, it's like being part of a group and establishing this group hierarchy. So you show commitment, you demonstrate your knowledge. On a personal level, when Georgia loses, do you feel that loss?
Oh yeah.
Or on the other side, I mean, when Georgia, and maybe as an Illini fan, I go to the defeat side of it. When Georgia wins, do you feel like you've won something? When Georgia loses, do you feel like there's a personal defeat? You have lost.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing because as a third party, when I see other fans of other teams take ownership, their team wins a champion and it's a championship, and it's like they're a champion and they beat me because their team beat my team. It's like, that's silly. That's ridiculous. But then I find myself watching Georgia, and when they lose, like, it legitimately, like, even as an adult, I've gotten better about it, but I mean, there's no getting around the fact that it hurts to lose a okay. big game when you think that your team is going to win a championship. And like I said, it seems ridiculous when you're being objective and when you're a third party, but there's some ownership and there's some, you feel like you lost, you know, and on the flip side, you feel like you won. I remember, I mean, even this last weekend, Georgia played Vanderbilt, which everyone knows is a mismatch nightmare for Vanderbilt. And friends I was with were like, why are we like, this is going to be a boring game. This is not an exciting game. And for me, it was like, this is going to be fun. This is going to be awesome. We get 3 hours of just total domination, see how many points we can score without giving up a point. And see if our third team defense can hold them. Like, to me, that's so fun. And to the people I was with, one of them played football at West Virginia, and they're both just like, this is a boring game. This is no fun. For me, I had a blast. I thought it was the greatest game of the week.
I think your friends lack a sense of, like, the dramatic arc of a season, right? You got to have some of those games that are, you know, high points, and those other games, which is just kind of run well, up like, the score. For me,
we got to see our younger guys develop. You know, we'll get the twos in and get to see. Like, I'm watching for all these things. I'm not just watching for, is it going to come down to the last play of the game?
Okay, so, you know, we don't rehearse this, but, you know, you're responding perfectly as a fan. Get the twos in. We have to develop the, you know, next year's talents, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and so as I was observing college football this week, and even when you're talking about it, seeing fans of other teams overreact seems crazy. So the two stories that really stuck out to me, well, and let's sum this all up. And so if fans are these highly knowledgeable, highly committed people that personally are invested in a team, fans very quickly become experts in their own minds. And when experts are going to tend to have strong opinions that are based on their experiences and their knowledge bases. And I think it does end up leading to some craziness. So, Doug, my favorite two moments of fandom for this week were, well, number one was Oklahoma's quarterback. Oklahoma, ranked number 4 in the country, is getting booed because he throws an interception, and they want to see the true freshman.
Yeah, they're chanting the backup's name during that game. Pretty phenomenal. And similar situation in the Auburn game. Which Auburn's one of my favorite fan bases, because they're one of Georgia's rivals, and it's brilliant branding, but they call themselves the family. Like, they say it's Auburn family. You're part of the Auburn family. He's an Auburn man. When he joins Auburn, he's part of our family now. We welcome him. And yet they're booing, first off, the son of a former Auburn quarterback, Pat Nix and Bo Nix, but a guy that in his first game for Auburn threw a game-winning touchdown pass in his first season for Auburn, beat Alabama at home, and was an Auburn legend. 2 years later, getting booed off the field by the fans. They don't want to see him anymore. They're tired because he hasn't played well for a couple games. Something kind of incredible about fandom, and we've seen that with Oklahoma. But, I mean, that's a team that's undefeated, that's positioned to make the playoff. And granted, I don't think they're a very good football team. But nevertheless, booing your quarterback, your 5-star quarterback, your quarterback with all the NIL deals. Both of those guys, by the way, have some pretty significant NIL money, from my understanding of things. This is, I mean, especially Spencer Rattler, getting booed off the field, which we could have a whole nother conversation about the NIL implications and you know, the quarterback play by guys like DJU and Bo Nix and Spencer Rattler this year, for the money that's been invested in them. But it says something about fans. It does say something about fans.
That's really an interesting statement that I actually don't even know how to respond to. The money that's been invested in them, right?
Yeah.
Taking up the what was Rattler's big deal with? Was it one of the chicken restaurants?
He's Cane's? I think his big one was Cane's, because I remember I did that article. And then Bo Nix has got the Bojangles, which is brilliant. It's Bo time. But Auburn fans have been saying that for years. Yeah, I mean, DJU's got the Dr. Pepper commercial, and he's had a really rough season for Clemson. And he he got, I mean, they were just banking on him. And to be fair, I mean, you go back a couple episodes of our podcast, I thought he was going to take the college football world by storm this year. I really did. And I think a lot of people did. And yet, you know, it's kind of shown that this first year at NIL, some of these brands have taken a chance on guys that maybe haven't panned out as well as they would think. Maybe in the future, brands will wait and see before they invest in these players, before they make them a spokesperson for the brand.
We'll see. The other, and again, in some ways, maybe I'm really kind of referring to almost like Twitter reactions. The other story that really caught my eye was the Clemson coach.
Dabo Sweeney
just getting drilled on Twitter from multiple angles.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has the sin of 2-2, and I don't know how many times I saw the video of him running down the hill,
full speed,
running into the field full speed.
Looks like Forrest Gump.
And they're just the tagline being running to the college football playoff to go back on his to suddenly be in favor of expanding the playoff to at least 12 teams.
Yeah, well, he's a funny one because he's very adamant in his opinions, and he's had this opinion. He said years back, I mean, and I say years back, it might have been 2 years ago. He said if there ever comes a time where brands are paying college players, he's going to quit coaching. he thought that was a terrible thing, and then now his quarterback is the spokesperson for Dr. Pepper. And then I think he's been against expanding the playoff because Clemson's had somewhat of a monopoly on the playoff as far as the ACC, and as far, I mean, they pretty much are a shoo-in every year, with this year being the exception. And yeah, but as far as this fans wanting him fired and all that, I mean, it's a guy that took the team. I mean, they've won 2 national championships, beating Alabama. They have a great, they're well positioned for making the playoff most years. They've built up somewhat of a recruiting powerhouse under him. But to me, the only difference with Clemson this year and other years, I think most years they're not that good and they just kind of put it all together at the end of the season. This year, they got to play Georgia out the gate, which is a 50-50 game. And looking back, even as a Georgia fan, I think that game could have gone either way. And the narrative changes so much for both team seasons. Georgia loses that game. It's another year. Georgia's still that team. Can't get over the hump and can't win the big one. And Clemson almost always loses, you know, to Syracuse or just some random team on their schedule. This year, it just happened to be NC State early in the season. And they're already 1 loss because they had that tough game to start it out. And so, you know, are they really that much worse than usual? I don't think so. But I do think I find it pretty funny that there's people that think they can do better than Dabo Sweeney as head coach.
Right, because that's kind of the great place that that conversation goes very quickly in terms of everyone coaching college football.
Are you going to hire Nick Saban?
Who has the track record of Dabo Sweeney, right? And you know, you come back to, and look, you know, one of the things that I think that people need to look at when they are talking about replacing coaches, and this is this, you know, for these expert fans out there, what is essentially the expected or the baseline performance for your team? When you sort of add up everything and you think about, let's say, the natural recruiting base you have, the size of the stadium, the size of the alumni base, the history, sort of the attractiveness of the brand, you know, probably just about every team kind of has a baseline record that's really the function of what's being invested. Right. You know, so maybe Notre Dame is a, given the history and the alumni base, maybe they're a 9-3 team or a 10-2 team.
I would say
team.
Like at the very least 8-4. Right. Bama, it feels like is a their minimum wins for a season is like 12.
Yeah, but this is because you have grown up in an era, you know, before Bama found Saban. They had some rough times there.
Oh, I remember those. I remember Auburn beating them 6 times in a row. The saying in Alabama was fear the thumb when they were at 5 going on 6, but going on 5, rather.
So if you're a fan like me, if you're an Illini guy, you know, what's the natural sort of break even point for that football team? It might be something like 6-6. And yeah. So teams really need to and almost no one sort of digs into the side of that and looks at the investment that is going on. And let's say that, and again, you just think about the difference. If you're the head football coach at Texas versus if you're the head football coach at Vermont, you're going to have different levels of talent. And then there's a second part of that too. It's not just sort of the absolute level of resources, but the comparative level of resources on your local stage. So one of the things that Ohio State always has going for it in the Big Ten is that they've got a revenue profile and a recruiting base in the state of Ohio that frankly blows away everything else in the Big Ten, but would probably be relatively commonplace in the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's the amount that you're devoting and sort of the amount you're devoting relative to the competition. And so when I think about Clemson, the Dabo Sweeney, this strikes me as almost kind of a recent phenomenon. It's been going on for a while now. But Clemson's not... is Clemson... You tell me, Doug, as a younger guy, is Clemson in the halls of greatness with, you know, and I don't know what the right word is, the truly elite, the Alabamas, USC's, Notre Dame's, are they permanently in that club or are they temporary members?
No, they're temporary members. Fortunately for them, in the college football playoff era, if you start college football history with the beginning of the playoff, absolutely, they're in that conversation. USC is not.
Right.
But when you're talking the history of college football, Clemson is not a team that's historically been in that conversation. Under Dabo Sweeney, they have entered the chat. They have entered the conversation. They have joined those ranks temporarily, like you said, and it's kind of on a year-to-year thing where it's like, it's felt like, you know, I think there's just this new expectation after you win a championship and particularly win two championships. When you're competing with Alabama, the expectation is to win a championship every year and everything short of that is a huge disappointment. Problem is there's a handful of teams that feel that way and the large majority of them end up very disappointed every single season. I think you look at LSU, that's a team that's historically probably much better than Clemson. They go have one of the best college football teams of all time 2 years ago. And I think Ed O's probably on the hot seat after this year or next year, but he hasn't really had a good season other than that one season. So it's kind of how college football works. But nevertheless, Clemson's a team that has consistently outperformed the USC's and Texas's of the world and Notre Dame's of the world in the last 10 years under Dabo. And yet there's still fans that think he's not getting the job done.
If you have a coach that puts you in it as a top five program, do not want that coach fired, right?
I mean, that's just the bottom line. That's the bottom line. That's, you know, and even as a Georgia guy and pulling for Georgia and watching them come up short under Kirby Smart several times in the last 4 years. And some of it is, there are games where it feels like if we had better coaching, we would have won this big game. Bottom line is when you have a coach that has you in the conversation every single year, you're always top five-ish. It's just a matter of time before you catch a break, before you get one special player, you know, the Cam Newton or the Tim Tebow type player that can just carry you. But you do not want to fire your coach if you're in that position. We've seen it a million times in sports. And I think the more iffy ones are like the Mark Richt, you know, 10 win, you know, he won 40 games in his last 4 years at Georgia. That's one where it's like, do you fire him or not? I don't know. Auburn with Gus Malzahn, like that was a team that was could beat Alabama every couple of years and made the playoff, or not the playoff, but they made a national championship game under him. And it's like, do you fire him or is it going to be worse without him? Like, what's their ceiling? What's their floor? It's kind of tricky with those teams. But when you're Clemson and you're in the college football playoff every year, except maybe this 1 year, so maybe like 6 out of 7 years, yeah, you don't fire the coach. That's insane. But that's fandom, man. That's what fans do. They overreact.
Well, and let me highlight just something you said there too. You know, you've got to update and be realistic about where your club's at because, you know, as you're having this conversation, talking about, you know, like Georgia's really kind of a fascinating one. In that,
oh, yeah.
Georgia's always been a nice football program. But, you know, the reality is, you know, and again, this is where you got to understand the outside factors as well. The state of Georgia has grown tremendously in population over the last generation. You know, the city of Atlanta has grown rapidly in size. And so Georgia was a really nice program that is now really has almost everything going for it. It's close enough to a major metro area. It's in a football hotbed. It's got an alumni base that is incredibly loyal and incredibly large.
Right.
It is the school in this state, sorry, Tech. So it's not like the Florida schools that are fighting with each other, the Miami versus Florida State versus Florida. And so it is an interesting one. Well, I mean, when you bring up Mark Richt, it's like, well, when do you move on to the next one? But Georgia probably is now one of those programs that has moved from a generation ago. They were probably, you know, their core, their sort of their baseline was top 15, top 20 program. They probably are always going to be a top 10 program as long as they have decent coaching moving forward. It's the reality of the in some ways it's the economics of the situation driving the on-field success.
Yeah, and they should be, you know, given the current circumstances. But the interesting thing about the Georgia fan base to me is it's much like Alabama, where there's this expectation every year in the sense of if we don't win a national championship, we are failing. Our coaches are failing us. We're not recruiting well enough. We're not. And historically, unlike Alabama, unlike Notre Dame, unlike USC, unlike a lot of these teams, Georgia is not a historical powerhouse at that level as far as championships are concerned. This is a team that, you know, has like hardly a handful of championships over its entire existence. I think, you know, historically Georgia Tech may have it beat in some areas, which is amazing to think now because it's not even close. And even looking at Notre Dame and thinking, you know, that's a team with all the history and all the championships. Georgia's 3-0 against Notre Dame. They never lose to Notre Dame. And in the Dabo Sweeney Clemson years, I think Georgia's 2-1 against Clemson. They're better than those teams, but yet they don't win the championships that those teams win. So the expectation to win a championship every year might be misplaced. When you're looking at a historical perspective, but when you look at the current circumstances and seeing, okay, they're in a recruiting hotbed, they've got these resources, they have no excuse not to be winning championships. So there's two sides to it. You can look at it from just a history perspective or just, you know, kind of modern football perspective, which I think Clemson is kind of looking at things only from a modern football perspective.
Clemson fans are spoiled and out of hand. But I do want to say something about the Notre Dame, because Notre Dame is a great example of what we're talking about. Because in some ways, Notre Dame is the opposite of Georgia in terms of the economic forces moving in Georgia's favor. A lot of Notre Dame's strength was being the Catholic school for the Midwest, the folks in Chicago and the folks in the Northeast, as that identity group has faded a little bit in terms of, you know, all these, you know, it's like imagine all these big Catholic boys on the south side of Chicago wanting to go play football at Notre Dame. Notre Dame has fallen off, right? And it's something that you don't observe because it's not something that's really directly connected to Notre Dame, but that was the foundation for them. So Notre Dame probably weakens over time. And look, Notre Dame's also a great example of how that brand equity from Newt Rockne, you know, still echoes through the modern era. Doug, the other story, I was at a party over the weekend where there are a bunch of folks from Pittsburgh.
Oh, man.
And they have given up on Ben Roethlisberger, I think.
Wow.
And so it's, you know, it's almost always, and look, just what we're talking about here today, you know, I start this off, you know, thinking about some fundamentals of fandom, but, you know, as you start to sort of break down all the examples, Oklahoma wants to bring in the freshman quarterback. Dabo Sweeney lost Trevor Lawrence to the NFL. I think the consensus in Pittsburgh is that the Steelers held on to Big Ben for 1 year too long. And so a lot of these stories, even though we're mostly talking about coaches, do come back to, you know, they come back to the focal point of these teams and these programs of the quarterback. Now, the other thing that, you know, as I was putting this together and just thinking about some of these examples, you know, this idea that fans end up acting as experts, sort of amateur experts, let's call them, passionate amateur experts. And when we start to think about quarterbacks, I will always come back to the Parcells rules. And I've probably talked about the Parcells rules a little bit.
I think we did here. In Fanalix U a little bit, yeah. Right.
That you know, Bill Parcells was the head coach of the New York Giants, Hall of Fame NFL coach, and he got a lot of credit for being an evaluator of quarterbacks. And his Parcells rules, I think he's almost faded a little bit, as you know, he's, you know, I don't know if Coach Parcells is actually still alive, but you know, he's, you know, his impact on the NFL is fading, right? I think he still has, I think Belichick may have been a Parcells guy, so he still, you know, has, his influence is still felt. But the Parcells rules included things like be a three-year starter, this was for a guy to be draftable, so to be a three-year starter, to be a senior in college, graduate from college, start 30 games, win 23 games, and then there's some stuff about touchdown to interception ratios and pass percentages, but so much of what he was talking about was really about the quarterback having a track record and the quarterback having enough experience, whereas perhaps you could say that the game is going to be the game is going to slow down for him, right? You're playing a new sport, you get out there, so much stimuli going on, it's too fast for you. As you gain some experience, you become an expert in your game, it slows down. So that was the big thing he was looking for. So as we have all these kind of coaching and quarterback stories, and we think about Ben Roethlisberger and this question, do the Steelers stick with a guy too long? Well, the other side of that in the NFL this year is we had this massive quarterback draft class of Trevor Lawrence, Mac Jones, Justin Fields.
Zach Wilson.
That these guys are getting hammered out there. So I think after a few years of people wondering if the Parcells rules were antiquated, that you put these guys in, you built the offense around them, you hand them the keys to the team, and they were off and running, and they were rookie salary, so it was the way to go. Maybe we're now swinging back to you know, you got to have the experience.
Yeah, I mean, common thought for me growing up in the NFL was guys would sit their first year almost every time in the NFL. Those rookie quarterbacks, they'd sit behind a veteran. And I remember as a Giants fan, it was Kurt Warner. The Giants brought in Kurt Warner when they brought in Eli Manning. And they sat Eli behind him for a good chunk of that first season before starting him. And I think the most recent example was Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City, not playing as a rookie, and then taking over his second year and never looking back for Alex Smith, who was a veteran, a very, very solid veteran quarterback. But nowadays, it seems like if you spend that first pick on a quarterback, you're throwing him into the fire every time. And we've seen examples of it working. I think maybe Lamar Jackson, Russell Wilson was probably the earliest example I can think of as in this generation of quarterbacks. So a lot of those dual threat guys, now that I think of it, like Kyler Murray. But yeah, more recently, you take kids straight out of college, that are used to playing, like Trevor Lawrence, for example. The team he was on was better than their competition for all but, what, three games of his college career. And all of a sudden, he's on a team that's far inferior to his competition every single game. He's behind a bad offensive line. His receivers are dropping the ball. And you do that to a couple of these guys, Zach Wilson, Justin Fields. It's not always pretty. I don't know that it would be pretty if you put Tom Brady back there, to be frank. I don't know if it'd be pretty if you put Aaron Rodgers back there. That's a very, very, very tough situation to throw someone who's never played an NFL snap
Let's stay with Trevor Lawrence. I mean, to me, you start to raise the question of, you know, suddenly, not only does this guy have the increased speed of the game, and he's behind maybe he's on a relatively bad team, now you're adding a different kind of mental component.
Yeah.
Right? And so part of this issue of having, you know, in the Parcells rules is, it's got to be this notion that they've got, and again, Lawrence is probably the outlier in all this in terms of how much experience he actually had at Clemson. Mm. But I think you're right. You know, and we talked about this a while back. How many games has he lost since high school through college?
Three, maybe.
And now he is like seeing the game of football from a totally different angle that's probably much, much less enjoyable. bringing in an Andy Dalton, you know, something, you know, one of these kind of journeyman quarterbacks, and let them take the hit while you continue to invest in the team. You know, does that pay two benefits? One, buys you some time to put some talent around them, and also, you know, gives the guy sort of an easy entry point to it. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows.
Well, I think, you know, another aspect of that is the health of the player. That's a hefty investment, a number one pick. Look, last year, Joe Burrow throwing him out there for the Bengals. Not that he wasn't fully capable of performing at just as high as level as the next quarterback, but tears his ACL. I mean, he was running for his life the whole season. Every time I watched him, he's just getting hit. It's a lot like watching Trevor Lawrence now or Zach Wilson or any of these guys. They don't have protection. They don't have weapons. They don't have... They are just targets, and they are just thrown to the wolves. And I gotta say, you know, there's a lot of people that are critical of how much money professional athletes make to go out and play a game. I don't know; these guys might be getting their money's worth to go out there and get absolutely destroyed by these enormous freak defensive players in the NFL week after week after week as a quarterback. Like, that sounds horrible to me. I'd much rather be the clipboard holder on the sideline. But
okay, well, as you're talking about physical damage, I think we've got to go to the most dramatic story over the weekend for these rookie quarterbacks, which is Justin Fields getting the call for the Bears.
Yeah.
Against a really talented Cleveland Brown defense.
Yep.
And I think I'm not going to look this up, but I think it was 6 completions for 1 yard.
Yeah.
And nine sacks. And the coverage of that is astonishing. And I was talking to some of the people in Chicago. It's like Justin Fields continues to be the most interesting media story.
Yeah.
Almost every week in, week out, you know, from, oh, he's not playing at Georgia. Oh, he's transferring and he doesn't have to sit out. Oh, he's leading a players revolt to get in there. Oh, his draft stock is dropping. Oh, yeah. The Bears are going to put Andy Dalton in there. Oh, fans now they've played him, and the coaching staff doesn't seem to have put any effort at all into designing a scheme. Yeah. It's remarkable.
Yeah, he's just that guy. I think he always will be, but he's a guy too that I thought he'd probably have the most success of any of these rookie quarterbacks. So far, it's looking like Mac Jones is that guy. Not that any of them have done tremendously well like Justin Herbert did last year, but Justin Fields certainly hasn't looked like he's going to win Rookie of the Year in his early playing time for the Bears. Not that he's always been put in a great position, but, you know, to me, it's kind of a killer for that fan base. That's a fan base that I think when Andy Dalton plays, as much as if you're the Bears management, you're hearing it from the fans because they want to see Justin Fields and they think you're blowing it by not putting Fields out there. You put him out there like they did this week and the results are the same or worse. And it's like, what do they have to cling to for hope now? I mean, we talk about hope all the time when we're talking about fandom. And it's like when you're Justin Fields, you know, savior
Doug,
player,
I got an answer.
Goes out there
I'll
and plays
you continue.
Like
that.
Yeah.
What they're hoping now is for the head coach to be fired before the next game. That's
yeah, and next
they,
will be the GM. Yeah, but you know, Fields is an interesting one, no doubt. I didn't watch that game, so I can't speak too much on his performance versus how much. I'm sure the offensive line was horrible if he was sacked 9 times, but he also is one that, I mean, there was a time at Georgia where he looked like a deer in headlights, and people love to look back and say, how did Georgia pick Jake Fromm over him? And I will be that guy. I will be that guy that's like, man, we made the wrong choice. Kirby Smart made the wrong choice on that one. But with that said, as a freshman in college, when everyone was being critical about him not being on the field, when he would go out on the field, he would take sacks. He would, you know, he looked like he didn't know what was going on. He really struggled a lot when he played elite competition. And so part of it is like, maybe it's coaching, but maybe like there really is something there. There's a reason why Andy Dalton was starting. There's a reason why Jake Fromm was in front of him, even though neither of them are the more talented athlete, the more talented quarterback. Time will tell with Justin Fields. I think he's an interesting one. The most entertaining rookie performance I've seen this year was Zach Wilson for the Jets. This was last week against the Patriots. Probably the single worst NFL quarterback performance I've seen in my life. In New York, at home.
I didn't see that one. I mean, I know both New York I think the city of New York is, what, 0-6 at this point?
Giants haven't won. I know that much.
Yeah, I think, I'll check in the stat line. Lawrence and Wilson both have 7 interceptions 3 games in. So it sounds like this has been, rough.
Yeah, it's been rough. It's, NFL draft time, all the hype's about these quarterbacks, your team gets them, and then it's like, man, I just can't wait to see these guys play. And then now they're out there. I mean, Wilson was throwing the ball straight. It looked like, part of me watching it was thinking, and having watched Bo Nix this last week at Auburn, I was like, what if Bo Nix had gone to BYU and dominated that conference? Would he have been the number 2 pick in the draft? Is it the level of competition college that made Zach Wilson look so good? Because he looked so bad. Like, he was throwing the ball directly to defenders. He was running with zero awareness of who was behind him and who was in front of him and what was going on around him. He's throwing the ball in the crowd. See, I mean, he was lost out there. And his team just kept putting him back out in the middle of the field to fail over and over again.
Well, and I think a lot of the rookie quarterbacks are looking like that, where it's like, the game just seems too fast. It almost appears like at the pro level, maybe there are 13 or 14 defenders and they're used to playing against 11, right?
No, actually. Yeah, it feels that way.
But on the other side of it, and this was kind of, looking at these things collectively, then you have Aaron Rodgers, who is back to having the ability to make passes where he's got about a 3-inch gap, just over a defender's hands to the only place where the receiver could have caught it. And I mean, Rodgers, in comparison to some of these young players, looked like a magician out there over the weekend.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And sticking with the Green Bay Packers there, that's a team that was heavily criticized for taking Jordan Love in last year's draft as a quarterback. But let's think about this. The way we're seeing these quarterbacks, and I'm playing devil's advocate here because I was as big a critic as anyone of that pick, but the way we're seeing these rookie quarterbacks perform, and contrast that with Aaron Rodgers, contrast that with him sitting behind Brett Favre for several years, is it not a horrible strategy for a franchise to take their next guy while they still have a veteran that can compete at a high level and let him develop for a few years? And so that when his time to start comes, when the time comes for changing guard at the quarterback, you don't have a Zach Wilson situation where you're feeding someone to the wolves, but you got someone that's prepped, that's been in the NFL, that's gotten used to the speed of it, and that can perform that level. That said, am I saying Jordan Love is the guy in Green Bay? I've just never been a believer in him, but I don't hate the strategy. I don't hate taking your next quarterback while you still have a guy that can perform.
Well, you know what? This is where the realities of the business, and the business is based on power and marketability and brands, where the realities of the business are probably creating something where you just got to navigate the process. Because I think, you know what, if you're the Pittsburgh Steelers, you probably should have drafted the heir apparent 2 years ago and kind of lived with what happened. As Roethlisberger is sort of Roethlisberger is probably a Hall of Fame player, but I don't think, in most years, Roethlisberger has not been an elite talent. Yeah. But if you've got a Tom Brady or an Aaron Rodgers, then I think, look, everything comes back to Michael Jordan. Everything comes back to
exactly
the last dance,
where
right?
I was going
to
go with this, yep.
And you have almost got to bring them in as a full partner and say, how many more years do you want to play? And, are you willing to help us work in your, you've almost got to, you can't just sort of pretend you're Jerry Krause or whoever the Packers GM is and that these people are robots. They've got enough power that you have to include them in the decision process. And that's got to be tough, right? And, players' egos, they always want to play too long.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that you have a choice unless you want to, if you want to avoid having these kind of really bad situations, which are almost like total resets. Jordan Love might be a great NFL player. He may also have had his confidence broken and this disruption in terms of playing a lot, mm-hmm. that this may have gotten into his head. It's, when the players have this much power, I mean, because you think about other leagues, if you're drafting in the Los Angeles Lakers, does LeBron get a vote? Yeah, he does.
Yeah, probably makes the pick. Yeah. But I mean, if we've learned anything from even LeBron, but LeBron, Jordan, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, anyone in the GOAT conversation, those guys have seemed to surpass your expectations for them with their age. Like LeBron James, who I, you know, it's not like he's my favorite player or anything like that, but for the age that he's at, I would have thought he would have fallen off. I mean, people forget he's 1 year younger than Carmelo Anthony, who has been past his prime for, it seems like, 10 years. And anyone in this GOAT conversation, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, and going back to Jordan, they seem to do that. They seem to stay at that high level because there's certain things about their game that separate them from everyone else that don't go away. There's certain intrinsic qualities about them that keep them playing at a high level. And so it's like, if you have one of those guys, I kind of feel like you got to just ride. Like, I'll let them show me that they're not going to be good anymore. I'm not going to bet that Aaron Rodgers won't be good when he's 37 or whatever age it might be, where you would typically draw the line and say, we got to have a different quarterback by then. Because LeBron's shown that, I mean, he's still, when he's healthy, he's one of the best players in the league. He can be the best player in the league on any given night. I think Jordan was that way. I mean, people talk about Jordan with the Wizards like he was some bad player. He was still an all-star for them, and he was still, you know, he still had that championship mentality. He just wasn't on a championship caliber team. I think if you surround that same player, I think you put him on the Lakers instead of Kobe with Shaq, he's probably winning a championship too. So, you know, with these Aaron Rodgers, Tom Brady type guys, I think what we've learned is you don't move on from those guys until they show you that they just don't have it anymore or that they don't want to play anymore. But Ben Roethlisberger is a tough one because the Steelers probably have some kind of bias to him because they feel like he's that guy because he won him 2 Super Bowls. But another guy, same draft class as Eli Manning and Phillip Rivers, both of whom are retired, both of whom were past their primes 5 years ago. Betting on Ben Roethlisberger to perform at the same level he did when he was winning Super Bowls is probably not the best bet. But I think they're going with that Michael Jordan strategy, the anti-Jerry Krause strategy of, like, let's ride it out till we know it's done. And I think now they know it's done.
Yeah. But problem is you got 13 or 14 more games this year. And you didn't draft a guy. You went Haskins. In the opposite direction. You drafted talent around Ben.
Doesn't really matter now.
It doesn't matter. Okay, Doug. So looking ahead, what's I know what I'm looking forward to in the next week. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I mean, if you're asking me personally what I'm looking forward to, Georgia Bulldogs, number 2, take on number 8, Arkansas at home. It's a noon game, which is ridiculous, but College Game Day is going to be there. I am not going to be there, unfortunately, but it's, I love college football Saturdays. I don't take them for granted. I wait for them all year. I'm enjoying the heck out of them. Giants are off to a rough start, as is my fantasy team. So NFL, I don't even know what I'm looking for at this point. It's okay, kind of like, well, the most fun part is watching the former Georgia guys succeed. And you're like, oh, Matthew Stafford had a good day. That's fun.
Doug, but I think that was the perfect answer. You know, if our role in this is the enthusiastic fan versus the jaded professor, it was the perfect answer. Because what I'm looking forward to,
I'm looking forward to hearing this,
is Tampa Bay playing New England on Sunday night.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
You know, these were two guys that were intertwined.
Where's that game taking place? Is it in Foxborough?
Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the New England Patriots.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's going to be something. I wonder, like, did the Patriots fans, like, kind of pull for Tom Brady against their own team? Like, I feel like Tom Brady is more of their history than than all the players on their roster right now combined. I mean, easily. And so, that's got to be weird. But, like, do they boo him when he goes running out for the Buccaneers, or when he scores a touchdown and Gronk spikes the ball? Are they booing? You know, like,
I don't know who's number 2 on the Patriots all-time great list. I mean, Drew Bledsoe.
Yeah.
Jim Plunkett. I mean, on the New England Patriots Mount Rushmore, there's actually 4 Tom Brady heads.
No, there's 3, and there's a Gronk. There's got to be a Gronk on there. But yeah, when Gronk spikes that ball in the end zone, or, you know, are fans booing, or are they just kind of like happy to see, you know, it's like seeing a, like a, the one of the new Star Wars movies where they reference one of the really old Star Wars movies where everyone starts cheering because they're like, oh yeah, that reminds me of my childhood. I remember that. I remember Chewbacca. I remember R2-D2. Do they start cheering or are they getting mad because they're like, hey, these guys betrayed us. They left us and won a Super Bowl for someone else. We hate them.
I'm not going to claim to be a Boston, an expert into Boston fan psychology, but as one of these sort of true core Northeast urban centers, you know, you got to think that they are hostile to the enemy.
No matter what.
And everyone becomes the enemy as soon as they change their clothing, right? The old Seinfeld line, rooting for the clothes. But I bet you're right that this is such a special situation that they don't know. I'm going to guess they don't know what to do, and they will actually end up cheering for Brady at points in that game.
I think they cheer for him. I think they cheer for him when they announce him as starter and he waves the crowd and they do some tribute to him. They do that in the NBA all the time with guys that, you know, like LeBron, they'll do something in Cleveland and the fans will, you know, be like, hey, he brought us a championship, did what he said he was going to do. We appreciate it. And we're here to watch him play, but we still want our team to win. I kind of expect that, but yeah, with it being the Northeast, I just think Philadelphia booing Santa Claus every year.
Right.
I just kind of bucket all of those fan bases, particularly the New York, the Philadelphia and the New England, you know, those fan bases. I think they're going to be booing. They're going to be hostile. That's just what they do.
When your history is your fans are a bunch of blue collar guys, and it was always cold and miserable in terms of the weather.
That's
the fandom you get.
Yeah, yeah. The Buffalo Bills. That's kind of them too. But I mean, I remember LeBron returning to Cleveland when he went to Miami, and they were hostile they were burning jerseys. They were all kinds of stuff. I don't know that Tom Brady is hated by New England in that way. The Patriots fans I know, they will say that their second team now is the Buccaneers because they love Tom Brady so much. They want to see him succeed and be the greatest.
I mean, maybe the danger is that they end up booing everyone. If Mac Jones has a tough game and throws some picks, while Brady's putting a bunch of points on the board, maybe everyone gets booed.
I don't know. But from a fandom perspective, that's like the Super Bowl of like, how will this fandom react to the situation? I'm glad you pointed that one out to me, Mike, because I'm now looking forward to that as much as anything else in sports this week.
And let's be honest too. I mean, I wanna watch every Bill Belichick press conference this week going into that game. Because, you know, that sort of head down, barely look at making eye contact, the hood on. Beautiful. A thing of beauty.
Acting like there's nothing personal, you know, just coach speak, acting like there's no, he's not concerned about, you know, Tom or any of that. He's not trying to prove that, you know, this is just about this week's matchup and winning one game. That's what we're going to hear from him. But you get the feeling that that's not what the media wants to hear. They want a storyline here. They want some sauce.
But he's going to do it in a deadpan voice that is going to have sort of hilarious undertones to it.
Beautiful.
Okay, with that, let's wrap it up for this week. As always, more content at www.fandomanalytics.com, especially content related to the Next Generation Fandom Survey. Really some great stuff out there, so please take a look. Beyond that, thanks for listening, and we'll talk again next week.